from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, despite gains in the last half century, women in the United States remain stubbornly underrepresented in leadership positions. They hold less than a fifth of the top jobs in both the public and private sectors, and the United States ranks 95th in the world for women's representation in national legislatures. That's below even Saudi Arabia and Bangladesh. Stanford Law Professor Deborah Rohde, author of the new book Women and Leadership, joins us to talk about what we can do about the gender gap, and we'll also get her take on the future of feminism under President Trump. Join us for Forum. It's up next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Although they've gained some ground in the last generations, women in the United States remain significantly underrepresented in positions of power across government, business, law, and academia. They constitute just 19% of the U.S. Congress, a smaller share than that held by women in Bangladesh, Bulgaria, and the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. And they hold just 10% of governorships and make up only 4% of Fortune 500 CEOs. Stanford Law Professor Deborah Rohde has studied this gender leadership gap, its causes, and its social and political effects, noting that it not only compromises our commitments to equal opportunity and social justice, it also deprives the nation of full access to the talent pool of available leaders. She joins us this hour in studio to talk about her new book, Women and Leadership, the politics and impact of the recent protest marches, and the future of the feminist movement under President Trump. A lot to cover in this hour. Good to have you back with us. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
There is kind of a paradox in this that I think perhaps our listeners aren't entirely aware of. You write about the Pew Research that shows that half of the men and a third of the women in the United States believe obstacles are mainly gone in terms of gender equity. And I say this is a paradox because there is, as I said in the introduction, underrepresentation in leadership, in politics, in management, in academia, across the board.
Right. Well, I've called this the no problem problem. The assumption that barriers have been coming down, women have been moving up, and full equality is, if not upon us, just around the corner. And I think because so many women have risen to positions of influence, we lose sight of all the contexts in which they're missing. And this facts are frustratingly familiar. I mean, you mentioned the underrepresentation across every major sector. In my own field, academia, women have been over half of college and post-college graduates for a considerable period now, and we're still only a quarter of full professors and university leaders. So the pipeline is pretty leaky when it comes to women.
And again, you make the call, as many feminists do, for women in leadership roles, focusing on women empowering other women and so forth. That's been a mantra for quite a while now.
It has, although I think we make a mistake if we think that just putting a woman in a position of power empowers women. As prominent leaders like Margaret Thatcher or, in this country, women politicians like Sarah Palin remind us, it really matters which women. And
is she still a leader?
Well, you know, I could cite any number of other examples, but you get the picture.
Well, it's complicated, as you say, and it gets into family roles and it gets into gender bias that is unconscious and sometimes not so unconscious, and exclusion from, and this is a big factor, professional networks and development.
Right. And in the book, I talk about the sort of what I consider to be the cluster of three main reasons why women are underrepresented: unconscious bias, in-group favoritism, the exclusion from old boys' networks, so to speak, and work-family conflicts. And all of those, I think, are important contributors to the underrepresentation of women.
And then we get into the question, of course, about what to do. And it always comes down often to votes and dollars, doesn't it?
Well, to be sure, there's no substitute for organizing around these issues and making a commitment to gender equality a priority in selecting candidates for leadership.
But you have to get the candidates on. We've done programs about this. A lot of women don't want to run for office because of all that they see as the burden of it and what, you know, the misogyny of it and all the rest that goes with it.
Right. And I think this campaign season has done little to convince more women to step up to the plate. And in fact, some polls after the election indicated that young women were even less likely to think they wanted political careers just because of all the vitriol and the sort of sexism on steroids that you saw. And that's a serious problem, because what the recent research indicates is that when women run, they can win. The problem is that women choose not to run, and particularly for the highest offices.
What about Emily's List? I mean, you know, there's been a lot of work and a lot of money there, a lot of shoulders to the wheel.
Yeah, well, that's made a huge difference. And, I mean, I we shouldn't understand.
I should probably define what Emily's List is, by the way. I sometimes make the mistake of mentioning things that people, I'm assuming people are aware of. It's a group of largely women who are in favor of and have put a great deal of effort into getting women to run for offices and to be candidates, yeah.
Yeah, well, and that's made a huge difference. I mean, yeah, we shouldn't lose sight of some of the progress that we've made. When I was in law school, 95% of Congress was male, 99% of the cabinet. And Richard Nixon said he was glad that there were no women in the cabinet. He didn't think anyone was qualified. So, yeah, we're not where we were. And partly that's due to women organizing around these issues and writing some checks, as they do for Emily's List.
Well, what about the Trump administration now? We might as well just get right into it. He's nominated Nikki Haley. He's nominated Betsy DeVos. I mean, there are a few. He's got a daughter who is apparently a major advisor to him. But we're still kind of really short on what we have a lot of male engineers and billionaires, apparently, I suppose you could say, or generals. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, the numbers speak volumes for the progress yet to be made. You know, women are grossly underrepresented in those positions. And what's particularly disturbing is it doesn't seem to bother him, or, you know, he doesn't consider that to be a major issue.
Oh, but he said nobody cares more about women than I do. Nobody will do more for women
than I will.
Some of his best
friends, yes, I'm sure, are women.
Deborah Rohde with us in studio is professor of law and directs the Center on the Legal Profession at Stanford Law School. Her latest book is Women in Leadership. She's also the author of other books we featured with her on Forum, The Trouble with Lawyers and the Beauty Bias. And should mention she'll be speaking at Stanford Law School on February 16th at 4:30. Let's talk about the march, because it was a march against Trump in many respects. There was a lot of sort of pushback on the march. I was reading some writers who happen to be women of color who were saying that, you know, white women were doing selfies and they were having their outfits on display. They had signs at the march. But what were they really doing for example, black people? What were they doing to stand up for black women, for that matter, or women of color? There is that divide. And there's a divide that you're talking about, but there's also a divide within the female gender itself.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, I think one of the most dispiriting things about this election is that, you know, despite Trump's misogynistic comments, his use of gender stereotypes to demean Hillary Clinton, calling her shrill and nasty, 53% of white women voted for him. And it's quite clear that they didn't consider gender to be a significant issue. And indeed, even within the Democratic Party, when Sanders supporters were asked about whether they thought that having a woman president was important, most of them just said, not especially. And I think the women's movement needs to do a much better job in reaching out to young women, to women of color, than it has historically.
Well, this one author I read in, I think it was a journal called Color Line, said, yeah, I have love and friendship and affinity with white women, but not sisterhood. I felt no connection to Hillary Rodham Clinton, though I wanted to feel it.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of women felt that her issues were not so much their issues. And frankly, the feminist movement has a kind of sorry history that was brought back by some of the signs in this latest women's movement. It used to be in the major suffragist parades, they were segregated. Women of color were required to march in a separate section of the parade. So, you know, there's a history there that we still have work to overcome.
And what do you think some of those comments you alluded to that came out of President Trump during the campaign when he was running for the presidency have cast a shadow, I suppose, in many ways, in many women's minds, but ultimately in terms of women in leadership roles, misogynist language and what may be seen as language of sexual assault during the campaign?
Well, right. And I think, you know, what's really troubling is for a lot of people, he legitimated views that previously were, you know, under the rock, so to speak. And now, you know, he's lifted it. And a lot of vitriolic sexism has come out.
So you talk about the need for access starting at the top, the need to establish structures to essentially counter sexism and counter misogyny and so forth. Where, how does that emanate now under the Trump administration? Or where, what are women to do? I mean, how do you see, in fact, progress being made now?
Well, I think it's important, first of all, to build the pool of new leaders. And there are a lot of organizations that are working to train young women, to encourage them to run for office. And we need to pull up our socks and write some checks and support those organizations, particularly those directed at women of color. I also think we have a lot of work to do in our own workplaces to monitor progress towards gender equity and hold leadership accountable. My own institution, Stanford, just had a task force on women in leadership that looked at women's underrepresentation, did a lot of interviewing to try to find out what the barriers were, and made a number of recommendations about how to increase transparency around progress and show women where there were opportunities for leadership and how to get there. And all organizations need to be collecting data that would enable them to identify barriers to progress and strategies of response.
You also write about the importance and necessity of alliances with men.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of my favorite cartoons is an old Punch cartoon that pictures a group of white men sitting around a table with one woman. And the chair looks out at the group and says, "That's a great point, Miss Teague. Now let's just wait till one of the men makes it." And I think the humor works on two levels. One, it sort of underscores the marginalization that women often experience. They have their points attributed to someone else. But it also points out the fact that when men make an argument for inclusion of women, it's heard so much differently than when women make it, because it isn't viewed as whining. We really need to build those alliances and support men who support women's issues.
And speaking of men who make comments, I like William Allen White's, which is quoted,
right.
Raise more hell and fewer dahlias. Let me invite listeners to join us in this discussion. We're talking to Deborah Rohde, and she's professor of law and directs the Center on the Legal Profession at Stanford. She has a new book out called Women in Leadership. And I know many of you have thoughts about women in leadership and how to enhance it, and perhaps concerns about the underrepresentation of women in, well, fields that you may be in, academia, corporate business. I mean, to some extent, we're talking about underrepresentation in, well, across the board, government and so forth. And some thoughts you might have, particularly about what to do, to why women aren't advancing as leaders and what can be done to help advance them as leaders. We welcome your involvement in the program, and let me invite you to join us now. The toll-free number to call is 866-733-6786. And we welcome you to the conversation, so please feel free to join us with any questions or comments you might have. Again, that toll-free number is 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. William Allen White said, "Raise more hell." What do you suppose he meant by that as far as women are concerned?
Well, there's another great quote. It says, you know, well-behaved women don't make history. And I've got it on a coffee mug.
I've seen it on bumper stickers.
Yeah, well, you know, there's some truth to it. Women need to make their voices heard. It's a tricky thing, though, for women, especially those who are aspiring to top leadership positions, because there's a wealth of data that suggests that when women are too assertive, not sufficiently likable, they're penalized much more heavily than men. And in effect, there's a double standard and a double bind. Women can be too assertive or not assertive enough. And what's assertive in a man is abrasive in a woman, hence the, you know, the nasty woman comment directed at Clinton. So, you know, my advice has always been to women that they need to be relentlessly pleasant, to, you know, make the point, stick by it, but try to do it in a way that's not off-putting. And I think that's equally important advice.
I thought Secretary Clinton tried a great deal to retain her composure and her poise and, you know, not to go off in any of what could be characterized as shrill ways, but she was still condemned. And a lot of those who condemned her said it had nothing to do with misogyny. It was just that, I mean, they called her a crook and they said she was dishonest and the emails were erased and all of these things were thrown out. And they said, that's why the enmity is so strong. It has nothing to do with her gender.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it is true that Clinton was carrying a lot of baggage that goes back a long way, and she wasn't forthright in a lot of respects, including her handling of the emails. And she wasn't an ideal candidate for this election when people were really looking for change, and she represented more of same. But that said, I think there's just no doubt that some of what you saw was antipathy towards women and power. And, you know, some of just, you know, the campaign slogans, life's a bitch, don't vote for one, underscore, I think, that double standard and double bind for women candidates. And Clinton herself pointed it out.
Let me just go back to the march again with you for a moment, and then we'll bring our listeners into this. There was, again, a lot of criticism from women of color. One article I read said, you know, should we put our line ourselves on the line for women who don't have our backs, you know, that sort of thing. It's a catchy kind of way of putting it. But in other words, the idea that somehow white women were not necessarily behind as much as they should be, black women or women of color or for that matter, people of color. And there was also this thing that came up that was curious about a criticism about co-opting the Million Man March in 1995 or the Women March of 1997, which were for the most part led by Minister Farrakhan. The phrasing here was co-opted and erased by clueless white women. That's how one woman put it in color lines. What about, I mean, there's a real divide there, isn't there, again?
Well, yes, and I think, you know, it goes back to the unbecoming history I mentioned earlier of women of color feeling marginalized in the women's movement generally. I think the organizers of the march has made a real effort towards inclusivity in the speakers that they picked and the issues that they chose to profile. But, you know, the real question is, you know, what can be done over time to generate a confidence that women are speaking with those issues. And, you know, I sit on the boards of some women's rights organizations and that are funded primarily by white women of means. And I think it is so important that we try to get beyond that image and the priorities that they bring to the work if we're going to really build a united coalition movement.
And again, as you said, 53% of white women did vote for Donald Trump. I want to get our callers on here, and let me begin with Tessa in the city. Hi, Tessa.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I was calling because I consider myself a feminist. I didn't vote for Trump, certainly, but I also didn't vote for Hillary Clinton. And, Michael, you mentioned a columnist who expressed frustration that she didn't feel sisterhood with Hillary Clinton and that she tried to. And I find it just insulting to my intelligence that I should have to try to feel sisterhood with someone with whom I don't share ideological or political views, and that I should have to join some sort of sisterhood in order to be a real feminist or to contribute to the movement.
Do you remember the remark of Madeleine Albright's? Any woman of special place in hell who doesn't support another. And here's Julie. Let me just dovetail on your comments, Tessa. Julie writes, why would women need to feel a sisterhood with Hillary Clinton or any other female candidate for office? Men don't look for a brotherhood with male candidates in order to give their vote.
Well, you know, men don't need to. men have no trouble getting into positions of leadership. But, I certainly understand where the caller is coming from. And I don't think, as some Bernie Sanders supporters put it, women should just be voting with their vaginas. And sure, there are other things that are equally, if not more important, in selecting a political candidate. But I do think that what women need to make clearer in terms of organizing other women around these issues is the need for candidates who support gender equity and the policies that would make it possible. And that's both women and men. And we need to put our dollars and our organizing efforts behind those candidates.
And let me thank Tessa for her call, and we'll go right to another caller. That's you, Lisa. You're on the air. Morning.
Good morning. I wanted to comment about this idea about young women coming up through the system in order to run for office and that sort of thing. I have a daughter that's a freshman at Seton Hall University, and she's very much a feminist and very much believes in the women's cause. But what she finds is, by and large, when she talks about those issues or she is passionate about something that affects women, she's accused of being a feminazi by both men and women. And what I see is, over time, her frustration in terms of her saying, well, no matter what I say, it's demeaned. And she's a, you know, she's a women's studies minor, and she's had so many people make fun of her for that choice, telling her that she's going to be absolutely unemployable, that it's a waste of her time. And so what I see is this persistent communication to these young women that what they're passionate about is not valid. And I really do believe that over time, it's hard not to buy into that. And I see that with her and another, a number of other young women who are continuing to try to fight this battle.
I thank you for the call, Lisa. And we'll get a quick response from Deborah Rohde as we come up on a break here. Deborah?
Yeah, well, I think that's a real problem. And I see it in my own students who are silenced on these issues lest they be tagged as
ridiculed, too.
Absolutely. And, you know, we need to do more to support young women in their aspirations. I love a New Yorker cartoon that pictures a man reading to his daughter, and she says, let's just skip to the part where the princess climbs the corporate ladder. So we need to get out some alternative messages.
And let me thank you again for the call, Lisa. We'll go to more of your calls, though we're coming up on a break here. I want to read a couple of tweets. Here's one that says, when you ask a man to run for office, he will. Ask a woman, she does an inventory of whether she knows enough to take office. And Noob tweets, it's important to hear the voices of women who do behave and have no interest in making history. We all count. More of your thoughts, more of your questions and comments are welcome. You can join us with Deborah Rohde. Again, the toll-free number is yours to call 866-733-6786 or email forum at kqed.org or post any question or comment you may have onto our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at kqedforum. Again, Deborah Rohde here with us in studios, professor of law and directs the Center on the Legal Profession at Stanford Law School. Her new book, Women in Leadership. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Stanford Law Professor Deborah Rohde about her new book about, actually, it's a book called Women in Leadership. And she'll be speaking at Stanford Law School on the 16th of February at 4:30. But in the meantime, she's here to talk with you and with us about the ideas in her book. And I want to invite you again to join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum. And the question we're putting out there really to listeners is in your experience, why do so few women hold leadership positions? Let me get back to something that came up before the break with Professor Rohde, and that was the listener bringing up feminazis and ridicule of women who study women's studies and everything. I was talking about this with Tina, one of the producers, about how a lot of younger women now seem to almost be anti-feminist. There's a kind of a backlash. They don't like the haranguing. They don't like what I would hesitate to call the, as they hear the haranguing or the tendentiousness and those kinds of things or rigidity. They don't like to be called feminazis, and so they go over to the other extreme.
Yeah. Well, it's not a new problem. When I came to Stanford as a second woman on a faculty of 36 men and said I wanted to teach a course on gender, the dean was horrified. "Did I not realize," he said, "this would type me as a woman?" Well, I responded with what I hoped was faint irony, that it probably wouldn't come as a shock to most of my colleagues. And after all, you know, what were my alternatives? But of course, from his point of view, I had missed the point. The issue was credibility, and to establish that, I needed a real subject. He suggested negotiable instruments. So it's still true that that women who are passionate about these issues and who make it a primary part of their identity and their political commitments can generate some hate mail and some slogans. But, you know, that's really the only way that you change history and make it possible for the next generation of women to find it a little easier than we did.
I remember doing a program, though, with Gloria Steinem and the new editors of Ms., you know, and the torch was being passed and all that talk about the next generation and so forth. In your experience, I mean, you're working largely with Stanford law students, many of whom are women, of course, but I guess the whole question comes up about whether younger women now, the younger demographic of women, are as committed, you know, especially young women of color. We've been talking about that kind of color line division.
Yeah. Well, it depends how you ask the question and what you mean by commitment. I mean, if you ask, do you support gender equality,
most of them would sign on.
Yes,
probably.
Of course. Yeah. But in terms of making it a priority or seeing it as a problem, that's where the work needs to happen. And it also needs to happen with men. Since you mentioned Gloria Steinem, I still recall when she was speaking at Stanford. A number of years ago, a woman said, "How can women solve the work-family issue?" And Steinem said, "Women can't until men are asking that question, too."
Well, here's Kristen. It says, "How would you advise women to talk?" I'm actually a comment by Bill I meant to write. "Unfortunately," he writes, "having kids sets a lot of women back. Maybe more equitable sharing of running households would help."
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's.
And then Kristen's remark is, "How would you advise women to talk to their fathers about women's issues when the father loves you deeply but just doesn't get it?"
Keep at it. There's some good research out there that shows that that men with daughters are more sympathetic to these issues, especially work-family issues. Our Chief Justice Rehnquist once wrote a famous opinion on parental leave that was quite a liberal opinion, and many attributed it to the fact that he had seen his daughter struggle with being a single mother and had helped her out. So he had a much better appreciation of the barriers that women faced around those issues. So we got to keep at it.
And we'll keep at the calls here and hear from more of our listeners. Saruti, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. As a woman of color in tech who's also considering her MBA, I wanted to bring up some of the barriers that I've seen, which include in career paths like consulting or even politics. It's all about being part of the old boys club, going out to even strip clubs late at night. There's sexual harassment that is very real and underreported. And there's a recent study that said that women and men in MBAs, when they are asked privately if what their ambitions are, they're very equal with salary expectations. But if they have to express it publicly, women underestimate it because of the backlash against that. So I guess I'm saying there's so much internalized misogyny in this. Being relentlessly pleasant or polite just doesn't work. We're already it isn't actually making the changes. And I think that the burden of success needs to be structural on industry to fix the system, create policies, actively pursue an environment that promotes diverse teams and leaders. So I just think the burden needs to be on business, industry, and, our government.
Well, thank you for that call. And it's pretty much in line with what you're arguing in your book, Deborah, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the book is largely about the structural changes that we need. But how are we going to get those changes? And the only way to get them is to convince more people, including women, that they're important and that they need to be in leadership positions where they can make changes happen.
And let me thank the caller and go to a question from Mary, who writes, "How should women in leadership positions address microaggressions without undermining their own legitimacy are coming off as a B word. Multiple times, my male counterparts have received most or all of the credit for my work. It is obviously important to try and address these situations, but I feel as if I am coming off as a complainer or petty when I do.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's tough. And, you know, women need to pick their battles. But, you know, I do think that humor is always effective if you can use it, and especially self-deprecating humor. And also, if it's really necessary to call someone out, do it privately rather than publicly. It's usually more effective. And, you know, focus on the problem, not the person. Try not to be accusatory about someone's motives.
Another comment from Jennifer. I appreciate this conversation, she writes. In public education, 75% of teachers are women, but we are dramatically underrepresented in leadership.
It's true there like everywhere else. And, you know, you get tired of repeating the frustrating facts, but they exist across all spheres.
And here's another caller, Bhavana. Do I have your name right?
Yeah, Bhavana.
Bhavana, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
My call. That's okay. So we're a Muslim family of color in the South Bay. My husband and I consider ourselves feminists, and we're raising a 10-year-old daughter who I think is committed to social justice issues and feminism. But we also have a 4-year-old son, and what we're finding is we need to be very deliberate about also raising him to be not just concerned about social justice issues, but about feminism. And we're very conscious of how he views his sister as being strong and intelligent and brave and courageous, and making sure that he has a view of women that is positive. And I think this speaks to some of the earlier points you were making about male allies. But I think it really starts young. And I think parents need to be aware that it's not just about the girl being raised to believe that she's strong, but also boys being raised to believe that their friends who are girls and their sisters are also strong.
I think, kudos to you for taking that attitude about your son especially, but he may have to stand up to some real misogyny as he goes into high school and teen years and so forth and so on. Yeah, so you're equipping him.
Yeah, I think we're trying to sort of pre-arm him or to counter the effects that he's getting already in society. I mean, I work, my husband works, but he still gets the impression that most women do not work, or, the daddy is the one who goes to work more. And so he's obviously not getting that at home, but he's getting it from somewhere. And so we're having to really be conscious about countering those social influences.
All right. Well, thank you. Any thoughts from you, Deborah Rohde?
Well, I think that's great that you have that commitment and resolve, because the culture oftentimes pushes against it. Walk through any toy store and, you know, the boys' sections are filled with guns and tanks, and the girls get princesses. So it starts early. It pervades us. And you know, parents can do a lot to raise feminist sons. And one of the best ways, I think, is equalizing household chores and making sure they're not gender typed. I remember when the first time I visited my husband's family, it had three boys and a girl. And my husband, who is now, you know, a terrific feminist and has been a great partner, was just oblivious to the fact that it was always his sister who cleaned up after dinner and did the dishes. And finally, the second day, I said, "Do you think there are kitchen fairies here, that dish just magically vanishes from the table and appears in the cupboard washed?" And that was the last time I had to ever mention it. So I'm fortunate.
He didn't see the kitchen fairies? Here's a comment from Heather, which gets to the heart of what you're just kind of talking about. She says, there's a crisis in caregiving in this country, and it has been the burden of women for way too long. That has to do with housekeeping, too. I mean,
right.
It's more of a balance than there was when I was a boy growing up, That's for sure. But she goes on to say, I don't have children, but I have a sick and elderly parent, and I can't even imagine how it would be if I also had to raise children.
Yeah. Well, it's true that women are and are expected to be the primary caretakers. And, you know, we talk about working mothers and their challenges. We don't say the same about – we don't use the term working fathers in the same way, and it doesn't carry the same implications. So I think trying to equalize those burdens is really important. And as many female leaders will tell you, and Sheryl Sandberg made this point in her book Lean In, you know, if your job isn't as important to your partner as it is to you, you know, you have a real challenge. So
I have invoked before my cousin Thelma's rule, which is that when there's a real emergency with children, it's the woman who hears the voices of whomever needs help. Listener asked, to what extent are women underrepresented as leaders because they do not want to lead or have other priorities?
Well, that's been the longstanding explanation that many individuals give for women's underrepresentation. It's a matter of different choices and commitments. And there was a famous New York Times Magazine article about the opt-out revolution. And, you know, the tagline was, why aren't women running the world? Maybe it's because they don't want to. And I think those explanations capture only a partial truth. It's true that women make different choices than men. They're much more likely to drop out of the labor force for family-related reasons or to take jobs that have reduced hours or part-time schedules in order to accommodate family needs. But what drops out of those opt-out narratives are the social forces that construct and constrain women's choices, the barriers that they find when they try to reconcile those roles, and the choices that men make both as partners and policy leaders. And if women aren't choosing to run the world, it's partly because men aren't choosing to run the vacuum cleaner.
Here's Emily. We mentioned Emily's list before, but this is Emily who wants to know, what organizations are you aware of that support women in leadership?
Oh, there are many, and I list them in the book. But, you know, go on to the – if you're interested in politics, for example, the Center for Women in Politics at Rutgers has a whole array of lists of organizations that work on empowering women. There are organizations that – work on business issues. Catalyst is one of the main national ones. There are a number of them in Silicon Valley around this. There are women's organizations in law, women's lawyers associations, both local and national. So,
and as you said, there's a list in your book.
Right.
And the book, again, is Women in Leadership, author Deborah Rohde. And let me go to more of your calls. Arkady, you're on the air. Good morning.
Thank you. Yes, Deborah mentioned Margaret Thatcher in the beginning of the program. And my question is, are there any important lessons that we can and should be learning from Britain, from Germany, from other places where they had one or multiple leaders in politics, female leaders, and they don't even make a big deal out of it? What are they doing right that we could be doing better?
Well, as I talk about in the book, countries that have parliamentary systems generally do better in getting women into positions of influence because the parties play more of a role, and many countries have, in fact, quotas that require parties to put women forward in leadership positions. That's one reason why a country like Saudi Arabia can do better on women's representation than we do. I think quotas are a non-starter in this country, but we could certainly learn from some of the efforts that parties have made in other countries to give more opportunities to women at an early stage for them to establish the credentials that would make them appealing as national candidates.
What an irony, though, that Saudi Arabia, which up until recently wouldn't even allow women to drive automobiles, you know, does better than we do, or Bangladesh. Or Elizabeth writes, this may not be in in your territory, so to speak, Professor Rohde, but she says, how many women are not promoted because of the scientifically documented changes that occur in women's brains after childbirth? It's often referred to as mommy brain. I've noticed it in myself, and my single women friends have talked about seeing these changes in their colleagues and subordinates after women return from maternity leave.
Yeah. Well, I think it's really hard to separate out what women are experiencing biologically and what they're experiencing culturally. And what they experience culturally is a lot of colleagues and superiors who don't believe they're going to be fully committed and don't give them the same opportunities for challenging assignments, don't give them...
Especially when they have children?
Right, exactly, because they don't think that women are going to make their jobs their priorities. And one woman lawyer who came back on after taking a short parental leave was so annoyed. She said, I had a baby, not a lobotomy. She was getting work that was, you know, not intellectually challenging or likely to advance her career.
Here's Danielle. Danielle, thank you for waiting. You're on with us. Morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to point out how pervasive the impacts of having a lack of women in elected office really are. I mean, obviously, you have a stifling of the pipeline moving up, but also looking down, I mean, if you look at local government, I think that local government, the workforce tends to be over 50% female, but the leadership, you know, the city manager, the county manager, is still hovering at 10 or 12%. It's been that way for decades. And those elected officials that are choosing those leaders.
Yeah.
Well, right. And, you know, we have to work at all levels and get more women into the pipeline earlier. And that's why we need to support organizations that are trying to encourage women to run for local office.
And, Danielle, I thank you for your call. I want to get right to another caller, and that's Emily. Emily joins us from Oakland. Emily, you're on.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I just wanted to ask a question about male representation in traditionally female professions, you know, the pink-collar jobs. I myself, I'm a therapist in a social services agency, and it's, you know, I think 80, 85% women, and my fiancé is sort of the token white male at a reproductive rights organization. And I really think that having more male representation in these professions could help just shift some of these ideas. You know, I work with a lot of really empowered women, and I think having men in environments where women have already kind of built up that empowerment and those leadership roles would help maybe shift the ideas about women in leadership positions and also the ideas about what is a, you know, female job and what is a male job.
I think that's such an important point. We as a society have been doing so much better at getting women into men's jobs than getting men into women's jobs. And you're right in suggesting that making those gender balances more equal does a lot to break down the stereotypes that caretaking is just women's work and that only women can be nurses or elementary school teachers. And when men have entered an occupation in a critical mass, it usually changes the nature of the occupation and often becomes more professionalized. It gets higher salaries. That's happened, for example, in the airline industry, where it used to be nothing but female flight attendants, and you had airlines advertising "Fly Me" with women in, you know, short skirts as the lure. Now that it's gender, much more gender balanced, you know, the pay is better, the benefits are better, and the treatment of flight attendants is more professional.
And let me thank you, Emily, for your call and read a comment from Talia, who writes, in my field, academic neuroscience, one often doesn't reach a secure position with tenure until their 40s. Thus, women who aspire to leadership must solve the work-family issue with limited means in a state of transient traineeship and with very little institutional support. I am lucky enough to rely on family for help, but many are not. Women must also find partners who will follow them as they pursue their career. These partners can be harder to find than one might like.
All true.
All true indeed. And let me get another caller on here. And we'll go to Larkspur. Sarah, you're on the air. Welcome to Forum.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to, you know, I marched in the Women's March, and I work for a STEM company that's been around for a long time. And I know after November, a lot of my generation, being a millennial myself, just kind of wondered what is next. And on an encouraging note, going back to work, I found that a lot of women had kind of refocused, even more so on building kind of a safe and powerful enablement network among our own team. So it's across teams and managers, and we make sure to give credit where credit is due, especially to other female team members on emails, et cetera, and just kind of pull each other onto projects. It does at times mean that we have to kind of check our own competitive instincts at the door to maintain this environment of mentoring women to women. But it seems to me so far to be a really effective way to build our team. But we do have to change the way we work, you know, from a competitive kind of dog-eat-dog methodology that's been touted historically to be successful to more of uplifting each other. And I was curious if that's, you know, if you've seen that before, is it effective kind of in the long game in terms of getting other women into leadership and management positions?
No, thank you for the question, Sarah. Deborah Rohde?
Yeah, well, I think that you point out a terrific example of what the research shows, that women tend to be more collaborative and more participatory in their leadership styles and in their working relationships. And that's generally an asset, and not just in terms of getting women into positions of influence, but for the organization in general, because, you know, people thrive when they have that kind of collegial support. And many organizations would be so much better off if the attitudes you mentioned were institutional for both men and women.
And I thank you for the call, and remind listeners we're talking to Deborah Rohde, professor of law and director of the Center on the Legal Profession at Stanford. Latest book is Women in Leadership. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. We'll go to more of your calls in just a moment. Let me read a couple of comments first. Mark writes, the paradigm of male-dominated business and politics is typified by two main approaches, hyper-rational technocracy and testosterone-driven displays of one-upsmanship. Neither of these approaches is particularly useful in a complex, multifaceted global economy. I would like to see if women could bring some alternatives. Do women lead differently, Deborah?
Oh, there's a fair amount of research on this, and, you know, sort of is how I would.
Well, you mentioned Maggie Thatcher. Well, she's as tough as nails, or was as tough as nails, as tough as any male, certainly, in a leadership role.
Well, right, and a lot of research finds that the differences aren't very pronounced, in part because the kinds of women who get to the top are ones who've been able to succeed in environments that are driven by those other more masculine values. Still, as I just noted in response to the earlier call, there is evidence that women tend towards more cooperative, participatory styles. And once they get to a critical mass in an organization, good things begin to happen in terms of those organizations' responsiveness to women's concerns.
There's a personal experience that Brittany writes of. She says, as a female in asset management, I've seen a huge gap in pay and promotion. My male coworker was given equity at 3 years, and I was told it would come someday if I don't leave to raise my family. It seems like they are expecting me to leave my job, and I have to prove myself before they give me any equity. Not uncommon. Let me bring another caller in, though, and thank you for waiting. Karen, you're on the air. Morning.
Good morning. I would just like to add to some of the comments about where to turn, where women can turn for help with leadership and equity, and that would be the AAUW, which is the American Association of University Women. We've been providing help, equity, leadership involvement, political involvement since the 1800s, and they're a very, very large organization. Our national headquarters are in Washington, D.C., and I would really encourage anyone to please go ahead and Google AAUW.org and see how you can get involved, how you can be supported, and how women can network right here in San Francisco and on the peninsula and throughout the Bay Area. It's a vibrant organization, and I strongly recommend it for any of these purposes. We have a legal advocacy fund. We have an educational opportunities fund for women who are pursuing higher education. So please consider AAW. It is one of the stalwarts of the suffrage movement.
All right. You got a good promotion in for AAW. Thank you for that call. I want to bring another caller in here from Albany. Ashwini, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I heard the other listeners talk about how she teaches her son to respect women. I think I also wanted to point out how so many of our parents focus on telling our daughters to be strong and equal, but we forget to teach our sons that it's okay to, you know, not be masculine or do explore with other things. I have a 4-year-old son who loves to wear nail polish every time I do, and in the summer he has pink toes and toenails, and then he loves to play with dolls. with Legos and cars, but then he often gets teased by other parents or laughed at by saying, what, you want a doll for your birthday, or you want to, you have soft toys, or, you know, things like those. And I think that's something that shocks me, because those are my friends who believe in gender equality, but they forget that it goes both ways. You can teach your sons or boys to be, it's okay to be, to cry, or it's okay to be shy, or, you know, play with toys that are, you know, traditionally meant for girls.
Thank you, Ashwini, for that comment. Response from you, Deborah Rohde?
Good for you.
Let me read a remark from a listener named Joelle, who says, I know all too many straight women who doubt their own strength and abilities. I believe Hillary was a victim of these women who, when considering a vote for Hillary, tried to imagine themselves as president and let their own insecurity choose a large, confident man who symbolized strength rather than a weak woman like themselves. Until we claim our own strength, we will continue to doubt our own abilities to lead and continue to let men rule this country. Interesting from a psychological point of view there. Mm-hmm. And one final comment from Janet, who writes, while my parents were both pilots with equal flight hours, I couldn't help but feel more relaxed and safe with my dad in control. I grew up in the Christian church, and I admit I have grown up with a deeply ingrained feeling that men should be the leaders of the family, church, and government. I do not continuously believe this as a 50-year-old, but I'm aware of this bias. Covered a lot of good territory here.
Progress yet to be made.
Yeah, and progress is all about what the new book by Deborah Rohde is about. It's her latest book, Women and Leadership. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you, Michael.
She's professor of law and directs the Center on the Legal Profession at Stanford Law School. We'll be speaking there at the law school on the 16th of February at 4:30 p.m. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. And our producers are Irene Noguchi, Judy Campbell, Tina Larberg, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai. Interns are Stephanie Roberts and Devin Holt. Senior editor, Dan Zoll. Executive producer, Holly Kernan. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.